From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Elections on Tuesday in various states and cities around the country resulted in big wins for Democrats, most notably in the state of Virginia, where all 140 seats in the state houses were up for grabs. Democrats, who already controlled the governorship, wrested control of both legislative bodies in a massive upset for the GOP. While Republicans held onto a governor's seat in Mississippi, they may have lost Kentucky. My guest is John Nichols. He's the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, host of their new podcast, Next Left, which features interviews with rising progressive politicians who explain how they plan to change the country. He's also a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and the associate editor for Capital Times. And he's written a number of books, including Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. And he now joins us to take a look at what took place on Tuesday. Welcome back to the show, John.
It's an honor to be with you always.
So first, let's talk about Virginia. That was the big story of the night. The state Senate and the House of Delegates were both controlled with narrow margins by the Republicans up until Tuesday. And now Democrats will be controlling both houses, and they already had the governorship, although, of course, there was a big controversy around Governor Ralph Northam. What's the big takeaway from that particular set of races?
Well, the big takeaway, and there's actually a number of takeaways, but the biggest takeaway is this, that when we talk about politics, when we talk about the control of states, we use a term called trifecta control. And trifecta means that you control the governorship and both houses of the state legislature. What that means is that a political party that's got trifecta control can implement its agenda. It can pass the policy measures that it wants to pass, in this case, for Democrats in Virginia, to really move things on issues like gun control, labor rights, wages, public education, and even putting Virginia on the side of the Equal Rights Amendment, which is a long battle in America, but one that Virginia will now very likely vote in favor of the constitutional amendment there. So this is big deal stuff from a policy standpoint. It's also a big deal because in 2020, we have the U.S. Census. The states will draw congressional district lines. And because Democrats will have control of the governorship and both houses of the legislature, there's a very good chance that they'll draw at the very least fairer lines, and a good possibility that Democrats could pick up a congressional seat or so. So that's all of these things are big parts of it. But underpinning it all, and the thing that obviously is relevant to all these races, is that Virginia has seen tremendous movement toward the Democratic column since the election of Donald Trump. They had a big, big victory there for the Democrats in 2017. They've now had another big victory in 2019. This is evidence that there really is a Trump factor, and you're seeing a lot of suburbanites, tremendous numbers of women, and younger people turning out in bigger numbers and voting against Donald Trump's Republican Party.
Just focusing in on some specific wins in Virginia, first-generation Indian immigrant Ghazala Hashmi beat a Republican for a seat on the state Senate. She ran not only on gun control, but on the Green New Deal, and becomes the first Muslim woman to hold a state seat in Virginia. A couple of others ran on Green New Deal platforms and won. So it sounds like Virginia is kind of shifting to match our more diverse demographic.
I think there's some truth in that. Remember, Virginia is a diverse state, but it fell into the Republican category for quite a long time because, you know, it was a state of the old Confederacy. It was actually one of the capitals of the Confederacy. It, for most of the century after the Civil War, was run by a Democratic machine that was very much in favor of segregation, very, very conservative. As that machine broke up, a lot of conservatives moved into the Republican Party. For a variety of reasons, they became a dominant force, especially in the legislature. The last few years have seen, you know, an undoing of long history. And what's driving that is the tremendous growth of population in the Washington, D.C. suburbs, in some of the suburbs and actually in the city of Richmond, down in some of the coastal areas. And this is a big, big deal because a state that people for a very long time have thought of as a conservative and a Republican-leaning state is now really, I think it's just safe to say, is a liberal state, or at the very least, a center-left state. And that shifts a lot of our politics, not just for Virginia, but for the country. It also tells us something that I think, you know, for those of us who study political science, something very exciting, because it is that states can and do change. And they change because of demographic shifts. And this is something we talk about with Texas, potentially.
Right,
with
Texas,
Georgia.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a big deal. Yeah.
So just a quick reflection from your part on Governor Ralph Northam, who just a few months ago was looking like a huge political liability for Democrats, right? Northam has very liberal politics. He's a pro-choice governor and then got caught up in a pretty horrendous scandal about donning blackface in college and, you know, just terrible, terrible, you know, he there was really no defense for the kind of racist behavior that he engaged in, and he refused to leave, which is kind of strange for Democrats, because when they do step into these scandals, often they do tend to fall apart and leave, unlike Republicans who dig their heels and then stay. It seems as though Northam pulled a GOP tactic.
Well, to an extent, or just a, you know, a political hardline tactic, yeah. And one that we should not necessarily celebrate. Yeah. You know, I think there's some argument that there ought to be a little bit of shame in politics, and that that sometimes you do respond to a failure on your part. But this is interesting because this is an international phenomenon, isn't it? Justin Trudeau had a similar problem in Canada.
Yeah.
And he survived politically. In Virginia, it wasn't just Governor Northam. You also had other prominent figures in the state's politics who ended up in very controversial, scandalous circumstances. They all decided to stay. And what I would say is the takeaway from this, there's so many issues. We could devote a whole show to discussing how these issues come into play and how to deal with them. But one of the fundamentals that I've begun to see a lot in our politics around this country is what I would refer to as a Trump effect. And that is that Donald Trump has really been identified, at least for progressives, for Democrats, as a bad player. And frankly, someone who's turned the Republican Party into an extremely politically, policy-threatening party. Now, this is, again, how progressives view it. And as a result, in that circumstance, the failures of Democratic politicians, while notable and significant, when put up against the reality of what Donald Trump and the Republican Party is pushing, tend to be, I wouldn't say forgiven, but it's just they don't have the power necessarily to diminish the party, right? To hold the party back or to hold it down. And I think at the heart of this, it is a reality that Donald Trump, in the views, again, of so many Democrats and so many progressives, is doing such harm to communities of, you know, to women, to minority communities, to the LGBTQ community, to immigrants and refugees, that folks say, yeah, I got a problem with what some of these Democratic politicians are doing, and I'd like to talk about it, maybe even, you know, have some major action on it. But if there's an election being held on some Tuesday in November, folks are going to turn out, and they're going to turn out in very big numbers to try and push back against Trump, Trumpism, and the Republican Party.
So let's talk about Kentucky and Mississippi, where there were two governor's races taking place. In the case of Kentucky, you had an incumbent, Matt Bevin, who is as loyal to Trump as they, you know, as Trump loyalists come. Trump rallied with him. And as of now, as of the conversation that you and I are having, although 100% of precincts have finished reporting, the Democratic challenger, Andy Beshear, seems to be holding a 0.4% lead, and Bevin has refused to concede. So assuming Beshear is the winner, that is a huge upset for Republicans in Kentucky. Is this the Trump effect again?
Oh, yeah. there's a subtlety to it. There's a Trump overlay on this, perhaps not the Trump effect, but it is a factor, at least to some extent. First and foremost, Matt Bevin was a very unpopular governor. He attacked public education, public school teachers. He just was a figure who, frankly, created a lot of discomfort, not just among liberals and Democrats, but also among a lot of even somewhat more conservative and rural folks who just didn't like what he was doing to the schools, to public services, a host of other things. So he was vulnerable. And the strategy that Republicans adopted to try and save Matt Bevin against a popular Democratic opponent, this being Andy Beshear, the son of a former governor, current attorney general, was to nationalize the race, to basically imagine that in a state where Donald Trump won by 30% of the vote, if you align with Donald Trump and say you want to push back against all the Democrats in Washington and all the socialists and AOC and Bernie Sanders, you know, all of these things came up in the ads on TV, that somehow Bevin could survive. Now, they put the the cap on this by having Donald Trump fly in on the night before the election, appear in Lexington, and essentially plead with the people of Kentucky to forget about whether they like Bevin or not, but to reelect him as a pushback against impeachment. And Trump was very, very explicit in this. And the next day, the people had a chance to do as their president asked. They chose not to do so. In fact, in Kentucky, you saw a 9-point shift in the gubernatorial race to the Democrat. That means Democratic nominee this year did 9 points better than Democratic nominee 4 years ago. Additionally, you saw a Democrat, essentially pull even a little tiny bit ahead in a state where Trump had this 30-point victory in 2016. That's monumental, and it's a real message. It's one that will resonate in Washington. People will notice that, especially because it's the home state of Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who is going to be saying, in perhaps relatively short order, to Republican senators, look, you got to stick with Trump, and if you do, he's going to come and campaign for you and help you get out of whatever unpopularity you may have. Well, Bevin stuck with Trump. Trump came and campaigned for him, and it looks like Bevin lost. So real resonance here. Some big messages that come out of Kentucky.
Now, in Mississippi, the Democrats weren't so fortunate. You had two state-level officials running for governor. Lieutenant Governor Tate Reeves seems to have beaten Attorney General Jim Hood. Jim Hood was the Democrat in that particular case. And although the Republicans retained control of the governor's seat, the margin of victory of the Republican candidate, I understand, is slimmer than expected. That was a state that Trump carried by, nearly 17%, I believe it was, in 2016. And Reeves won this race by a much slimmer margin.
That's exactly right. And Sonali, you're focusing on what really matters here. I know that in our American media, which is, fast-paced and anecdotal quite often, there's a desire to focus on that top line, who won, who lost, right? And that's all you take away. What's important is to look at the shift, at the swing, because that's what tells you not just about these very red states of Kentucky and Mississippi, but potentially about other states, where the kind of pattern of our politics is. Now, Andy Beshear won in Kentucky with a 9-point shift to the Democrats. In Mississippi, Jim Hood had a 13-point shift.
Oh, wow.
To the Democrats. It's just the Democrats started out farther down. That's just reality. So the bottom line here is, out of both Kentucky and Mississippi, we get a lesson. Our lesson is not that, Democrats are going to win everywhere or that it's going to be easy for them. But it is that where Democrats compete, where they try, and where they build sort of a new style campaigning, not necessarily as liberal or progressive as many folks around the country would like, but that embraces public education, embraces public services, aligns with trade unions, in the case of Bashir especially, was very pro-choice on an issue that's often been, you know, one where Democrats have been softer in Kentucky. They can do very well, and they can start to build out coalitions. The other thing that you saw in both Mississippi and Kentucky, and of course in Virginia, was a willingness to do a multi-tiered organizing, heavy emphasis on organizing, more money into organizing than in the past, and that organizing occurring in cities where Democrats have, you know, a base, and building up that base, bumping that turnout, really mobilizing people who are, if you can get them to the polls, are going to vote Democratic, but also going into suburban and rural areas and not trying to shift Trump voters, at least in most cases, but more putting resources into trying to mobilize and excite people who don't always vote.
Which, of course, is a great preview for next year's presidential race.
Exactly. And that's less.
Staying on Kentucky for a bit, Kentucky is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's home state. Some have suggested that Andy Beshear's win, and it's not technically official yet, but it's looking likely, is bad news for Mitch McConnell's own re-election. What do you think?
Really bad. There's no question about it. You know, everybody's saying how Matt Bevin is this kind of unpopular guy, and they're big. All the people who are saying on Tuesday, the Republican pundits and politicians are saying on Tuesday, yeah, you know, Matt Bevin, we got to reelect him. He's a great guy. Right. On Wednesday, suddenly they're saying, oh, he's very unpopular. You know, it's amazing that he was even able to, you know, mount a campaign. So they're acknowledging Bevin's unpopularity. What they don't seem to be acknowledging is that in polls out of Kentucky, Bevin's popularity was quite parallel to Mitch McConnell's. Mitch McConnell is very, very unpopular at this point in Kentucky. And nationalizing the gubernatorial race this year, trying to say, you know, just go and vote for a Republican, whoever it is, didn't work. For Mitch McConnell, that's a scary thing going into next year.
Right, because it's going to be largely the same voters. The race for governor is a statewide race. Race for your senator, your Senate representative to Congress, is a statewide race as well. So we'll have to see.
I mean, there are lessons here. Now, presidential year is different.
Yeah.
Trump will be at the top of the ballot. And, you know, Trump is, let's not lie to ourselves. You know, if Trump is not removed from office via the impeachment process, he will be undoubtedly the Republican nominee. And there's a very good chance he could carry Kentucky, likelihood probably that he'd carry another number of other southern states, because it's not just Trump then, it's who Trump is running against. But what we have learned, which is fascinating, is that because of this gubernatorial race, people were quite capable of making that separation. I think probably, you know, remember, I'll give you an example of one county in Kentucky, Elliott County in eastern Kentucky. This is a rural county. In 2016, it voted for Trump by 40 points. If I'm correct, I think I remember this right, Trump got about 70% of the vote. Hillary Clinton got about 26% of the vote. It's overwhelming victory for Trump. Tuesday night, Andy Beshear won that county by 20 points. So, you know, the message here is that even people who might vote for Trump at the national level can vote for a Democrat in a statewide race, be that, you know, for governor or potentially, certainly not a certainty, but potentially the Senate. So, yeah, does Mitch McConnell have a race on his hands? I say yes.
Let's look at some bad news, and that is at the city council level in Seattle, Washington. This became a race of a national significance because of Amazon. Amazon, the online retail giant who is headquartered in Seattle, has declared as their enemy the socialist candidates on the city council, most notably Kshama Sawant, who has made a name for herself by successfully pushing for $15 an hour minimum wage, and who has railed against Amazon's takeover of their economic and political system in Seattle. They poured nearly $1.5 million, an unheard of amount, into city council races. And as of now, although mail-in ballots, I understand, have yet to be counted, Sawant looks like she might have lost to the Amazon-backed candidate. What does this mean for you? What's the significance nationally?
Well, it's hugely significant. One council up front, Seattle has a massive level of mail-in voting, and a lot of those votes are cast on Tuesday. So those votes they haven't even, they may not even have arrived at the election office yet. So there is still a real chance that Shama Sawant could win this race, as well as some of the other, you know, for lack of a better term, anti-Amazon candidates. We'll see how the vote count goes. My sense is that it will probably end up much closer, certainly, than what we're seeing at this point. So let's not close the book on that one yet. With that said, the lesson from Seattle is massively significant, and that is that these tech giants, which have so much money, they don't even know what to do with it. I mean, literally, their big decision is where, you know, what bank to put all this money in, because it's just piled up. They, with a tiny expense for them, can have a huge influence in politics. This is a very dangerous reality. Obviously, what they want to do is create a circumstance where people just don't feel comfortable criticizing them. That has significance not just for Seattle, but all the way up to the presidential race, where Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been quite critical of big tech. So the lessons out of Seattle are unsettling, they're concerning, and they remind us of something, that if you are a reformer or a change activist and you've got an issue you want to focus on, say tech monopolies, you also have to focus on campaign finance reform, because you cannot imagine that these huge companies won't use their massive resources to try and defend themselves from, you know, necessary regulation at the local, state, or national level. Seattle is a real test ground, and it's one we'll be talking about what's happened in Seattle this year for many years to come.
A couple of other races. I mean, there are, of course, too many for us to discuss in detail every single one, but New York City residents approved an interesting measure on their ballot that would essentially allow them to do ranked choice voting on some types of elections. What sort of victory does this represent for you? What does it mean for future elections in the city?
Well, it was a huge vote for ranked choice voting. It won by a very large margin, which was quite interesting.
And explain ranked choice voting for our audience who's not familiar.
It's not very complicated, although, you know, it's a real change for America. And in America, we have in most of our elections, a very traditional first past the post. You know, a bunch of candidates on the ballot, maybe just two of them. You vote for one. Whoever gets the most votes, even if it's just one vote more, gets elected. In ranked choice voting, it's a little different. You have a bunch of candidates whose names are on the ballot. You get your ballot and you rank them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? And if your first candidate, the candidate gets the most votes, gets over 50%, well, that candidate's won. But if nobody gets over 50%, then you start taking the votes from the lowest candidate and attaching them to the highest candidate. What that means is that ultimately you get a nominee who is the choice of a majority, even if it isn't in that first round there. You have relative rounds where you reassign the votes. It can start to sound complicated, but in reality, it's a very simple system. It works in places all over the country and all over the world. And the effect of it is that a candidate who is popular, but maybe doesn't in and of themselves have a majority, can get votes from a candidate who is maybe less popular but shares their views. To give you an example, let's say in 2016, where you had the presidential race, in a state like Wisconsin, where I live, if you'd had ranked choice voting, there's a very good chance that Hillary Clinton might well have won, Donald Trump might well have lost, with the reassignment of votes from, say, Jill Stein and some of the other candidates. I'm not assuming that that would always happen. And in fact, I know that there are people who might not choose to go that route. But the reality is that ranked choice voting does give a chance to sort of create ideological groupings. Like if you've got three or four liberal candidates, they can effectively assign their votes. In the presidential race in 2020, if ranked choice existed, you could have supporters of Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Andrew Yang, reassigning, you know, like ranking their votes and then having them move up. We could belabor it, but the bottom line is this is a reform that I think, while it's sometimes controversial, gives a real opening, especially in New York, for progressives perhaps to do even better.
Finally, let's talk about Louisiana, where there is a runoff gubernatorial race taking place the middle of this month. Donald Trump, who I think really believes that he is still a winning factor rather than a political liability, is going to Louisiana to rally for the Republican candidate there. Give us a sense of what's happening in Louisiana.
Well, Louisiana is a very, very Republican state, at least at the presidential level. But it's a state where they have a Democratic governor. The Democratic governor there is quite conservative. He's more conservative than Andy Beshear in Kentucky, as an example. But he has been pro-public education. He's tried to expand access to health care. He has a pretty good level of support from the unions, which remain a force in New Orleans and some other cities. And this governor, John Bel Edwards, is seeking re-election. This is going to be a very interesting circumstance. There's good evidence to suggest that the Democratic incumbent is more popular than the Republican. Trump is again going to try and nationalize this race. I can tell you this, if the Democrat, John Bel Edwards, is re-elected, if he wins a second term and beats the Republican after Trump wades into this, there is going to a lot of people in Washington are going to pause and say, you know what? It doesn't look like Donald Trump is that helpful when he shows up. And that has tremendous potential to start, all sorts of new discussions, not just about the 2020 election, but also about some policy issues as well for Republicans, at least some Republicans who might be entertaining the notion of breaking with him on a particular issue. And yes, it has ramifications as regards impeachment, because the president would like people to believe that impeachment is a third rail. If Democrats touch it in Washington, that it will defeat Democrats everywhere. If Beshear ends up winning in Kentucky and the incumbent Democrat ends up winning in Louisiana, there's awfully good evidence, even from very, very red states, that impeachment is not a third rail, that it doesn't damage Democrats. And I suspect that evidence would embolden many members of the Democratic caucus in the House and in the Senate.
So I want to thank you so much for joining us today, John. So much more that we could continue discussing, and we'll see certainly how these races play out. Thanks so much. Really appreciate your time.
It's an honor always to be with you, Sonali.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much. My guest has been John Nichols. He is a national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, host of their new podcast, Next Left, featuring interviews with rising progressive politicians who explain how they plan to change the country. He's written a number of books, including A Horseman of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America, and many, many others. We've been discussing the election results from this past Tuesday. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, do subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.